welcome everyone back to this latest episode, this latest session of GDPR Radio. My name is Ollie Rear, as some of you may know. I'm one of the consultants at DPP. I'm joined, as ever, by my esteemed colleague, Phil Brining. Phil, afternoon.
Thank you. Hello. How are you doing?
All good, thanks. So, a bit of an informal session. Interaction is absolutely paramount to these, so please do get involved. If you've got any comments, questions, suggestions, anything at all, either pop it in the chat or unmute and dive off. We really want it to be your session as much as it is ours. So pretty informal this week. We're just going to have a chat about what's been in the news, what we've been working on, anything of interest. You know, at the end of the day, it's an opportunity for the community to come together and have a little bit of a natter. So you were talking about that housing management system, Phil. Is there anything else you were going to say on that before?
No, I haven't really got under the skin, but I was kind of saying, well, how do you manage data retention? And there's a lot of metadata around the records and the fields on the record. So what she said to me, and I haven't seen it in practice yet, so big caveat, is that you can write business rules and business logic to handle the storage time on fields, on records, in objects in the database. So you could say, for instance, this particular record has got a life of 3 years from the date the ASB case closed field was populated. Equally, you could say, this tenant record's got a life, or this aspect of it's got a life of 7 years because it's financial data or something like that. So it sounds really granular in the way it approaches a lot of different aspects, actually, not only user control, but also data retention and other aspects. It's only a year old, but still building it. But it sounds really quite interesting, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic for those in the housing sector, to be honest, because, I mean, we see a lot of this. Well, I don't know about you, but I certainly do. If you come in at the ground floor with these matters, you actually consider data protection implications from the get-go in terms of your systems and your processes, and you build them in from the start, the management of your information assets.
You'd like to think so, yeah. I mean, we're doing three data protection impact assessments, we're involved with three projects where housing associations are building their own housing management system on the Microsoft Dynamics platform. One we've gone in, been invited in from the very outset before the project's even started, and that's the best one really, because we're helping to advise around some of these factors, to try and really do privacy by design and by default. One we've come in halfway through, and now we're saying, "Oh, you should have done this," and they're saying, "Oh God, it's just too late. We'll have to change it in a later release," which of course is costly. Now, one of them has asked us to assess their solution at the end of the process. Well, again, we're saying, "Well, in our opinion, you haven't really done that as well as you could have done." And again, they're saying, "Well, it's too late." So, it beats me why we don't. Well, not us, but privacy professionals don't get invited into these, technical projects from the outset. Why is it always last minute?
Well, I think we've often spoken about that, haven't we? And the fact that sometimes it's just purely a cultural thing, that there's this sort of, misconception that data protection is all about blocking us from doing what we want to do, and it's admin and it's paperwork. But, at the end of the day, if you actually build it in, as we're saying, then it smooth everything over, and it facilitates your processes tenfold. Yeah. So it is often,
I don't know if anybody on the session's got anything to kind of share about that, whether they we're just seeing that one or two instances of what I would say is not great practice, and these are oddities rather than the norm. I don't know.
I definitely tend to agree with you on that front in terms of it being oddities. Yeah, I don't know if anyone's got anything to contribute on that, but if not, I saw you sent over a couple bits and pieces about compensation particularly, which is a topic that we've talked about quite a lot over the past few weeks, I think, and I thought that might be interesting to get stuck into.
That actually sort of come out, Ollie. I saw a story yesterday on the BBC, and it's now in The Guardian and Reuters and everywhere. Well, not everywhere. That's a bit of a generalisation. A few places about TikTok being being sued by the former children's commissioner for misuse of data. Anne Longfield is behind that. Anyway, she's engaged a law firm called Scott and Scott. And if you go to the Scott and Scott website, then you'll see that they're representing Anne Longfield. But what they're suggesting is that they're pursuing TikTok for billions of pounds, like £2,000 compensation per child whose data has been misused. Now, I don't have any idea how they distribute that, but if they won that level of compensation. But what prompted me looking at compensation was that the Lloyd v. Google is coming back to the Supreme Court next week for a two-day hearing. So again, that'd be really interesting to see how that pans out, because if you remember, this is the former editor of Which, Richard Lloyd, who took a case against Google for this Safari. You remember the Safari workaround that affected all Apple users? It was about the way the cookies were written, and you know, even if you opted out, they were still written if you used Safari. Do you remember that?
Yes.
The Safari
workaround. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's that case that's coming back, and the High Court, the Supreme Court, is expected to you know, make some landmark judgments really about non-pecuniary loss and distress and things of that nature. So that'll be really fascinating next week. I'm not sure the judgment will be out next week, but the week after, I'd be really interested to see how that works.
Yeah, definitely. I think I did have a look actually at the bits you sent over on that, and I think there's sort of two key themes which I thought were fascinating in terms of what might come out of it. Is the first of which is that this is essentially closer to the American style class action, isn't it?
Yes.
Which traditionally we've not really indulged either in this country generally or in this area specifically. So it's interesting to see how that plays out. And I think part of the reason that he's able to bring this action on behalf of, you know, thousands of other people, I think it's
because 4 million people.
Is that many?
Yeah.
Crikey.
Yeah.
I think because he's saying that he's only bringing a claim for loss of control over data, and therefore he's not bringing people's specific circumstances into it. Therefore, he's representing all of them in one fell swoop. Is that broadly?
Yeah, that's broadly it. And I found another really good article, which is only published this week, 19th of April, from Beal & Co., again, a good law firm. And that's looking back over several compensation claims and comparing the awards for compensation from the highest was £18,000. You'd have to read it to find the tight circumstances, but loss of control, distress caused by loss of control in Halliday Creation Consumer Finance Limited, they were awarded £750 compensation for that. So there's a broad range from 750 up to £18,000 for compensation, but it all depends, according to Beal & Co., you know, on the nature of the distress caused and whether this is a general data protection breach, which they say is not much distress, or whether you're part of a limited list that was leaked out, or, you know, you were deliberately you know, processed unlawfully, in which case they're saying it's probably worth more in terms of compensation. But it's really interesting. So this Supreme Court case is going to be fascinating to see how that, you know, what that says, you know, how that lands out, how the judgment goes.
Yeah, absolutely. You touched on a point there which I sort of thought about quite recently, actually, or it only sort of dawned on me quite recently, but you were rattling off examples there saying perhaps your data had been included,
you say,
or your name
rattling on about or rattling off
rattling off but yeah, no, in instances where maybe, you know, your name's been included on a list that's been leaked, or you're part of a database that's been unlawfully processed, or whatever it might be. But it only occurred to me, and potentially this is, you know, my fault and I might make myself look a bit foolish, but it only occurred to me like very recently when I was reading Article 82, is it, for compensation?
Yeah,
it is. That actually the wording doesn't limit the ability to make compensation claims to data subjects. It's any person who suffers the material or non-material damage, which means that in theory, it extends to family members of people who have been affected by data breaches. It extends to people whose data hasn't been involved in unlawful or breach processing. And that really got me thinking, because I thought it really sort of got me thinking about this, especially when we're talking about the context of distress in all of this, because obviously you know, that's really quite broad. And I know that we work quite heavily in the social housing sector, for instance, and it's, you know, easy to see a situation where maybe a data subject has had their information breached and has suffered negative consequences as a result of it, but that's caused significant distress to their family, and maybe their family might be entitled to claim for something. I just thought that was really interesting. I'd be curious to see if ever something like that does get brought.
I think it's a good point, really, because again, if you look at from memory, right? I'm talking memory, so correct me if I'm wrong, but from memory, the personal data breach stuff, it was all about the likelihood of harm caused to natural persons. It doesn't say data subjects on the list of breached data. It says natural persons. So again, theoretically, it goes beyond, you know, those who were subject to the breach, you know, in terms of their personal data being breached. And I think that's probably a deliberate wording. I think that my view is the GDPR is aiming to be a fairly broad piece of legislation, and it uses broad wording to try and make sure it is broad rather than narrow and people wiggle out of their responsibilities.
No, I think you're spot on. And it's actually something which we find, well, at least I found quite difficult to sort of get my head around in the first instance, and then subsequently one of those potential sticking points in training for some of the new guys that we bring in terms of actually carrying out sort of breach and incident management and reporting on breaches, is actually just sort of trying to get your head around what the consequences of a breach might be, because you're talking about not just limited to the individual, but their family members or, you know, their neighbours, whatever it might be. And that's really sometimes quite difficult to wrap your head around, isn't it?
Yeah. This is Steph posted a really fascinating thing in the chat. I recommend you go and have a look at this, because, I mean, you know, remember when we've kind of done our IGF, our information governance framework, and we've put in a framework for trying to evaluate likelihood of harm. Well, what this does is it's got some superb. So thank you very much, Steph. I've not seen this before. This is superb. You know, loss of opportunity, economic loss, social detriment, loss of liberty. There's a whole raft of consequences, let's call them. And you know, this is great. You know, and it splits it down into employment discrimination, insurance benefits discrimination, housing discrimination. And this is actually discrimination by algorithm, but the same kind of theory can be picked up and adopted or modified to meet other needs. But it's a really good. Oh, this is fantastic. I read this. I'm going to read this tonight, definitely, in detail.
Yeah, to be honest, I try not to take my work home with me, but I might join you on that. This looks fascinating.
Yeah, we'll have to crack a beer and have a look through it. There's a lot of, tell you what, there's an awful lot of literature reviewed in compiling this. So it'd be interesting. So yeah, it's really good. That thank you, Steph. It's in the chat if you want to have a look at it, everyone. It's I think a quick read. It's only 8 pages, but I think it'd be quite thought-provoking.
Yeah, absolutely. And very topical as well. I mean, I'm seeing increasingly, you know, more and more talk around biased AI and the issues around that. I mean, obviously the key one there being racially biased AI because of the way it's programmed.
Yeah.
But sort of more broadly, and I suppose this feeds into it, you know, unfairness by algorithm. But yeah, fascinating.
What's interesting about AI though is that theoretically AI will learn to either increase the bias or remove the bias in theory.
Like, yes. Yeah.
Or am I making
in
that
theory?
Up?
Well, I don't know. Well, I suppose it depends how you've coded it. I suppose it depends how it learns and what you feed it. I'd imagine. I don't claim to be an expert on machine learning.
I thought you were, Ollie. Now, listen, I was talking with Dilik this week about CCTV. So she'd been asked in a steering group meeting, one of her clients, about paying the annual fee for CCTV. And she said, no, you'd have to pay an annual fee for CCTV. And they said, well, we'll have a look at the ICO's guidance on the matter. And it talks about paying an annual fee for CCTV and putting it on your registration. So Dilik rang me. I said, it's all changed, Dilik. It all changed a couple of years ago. You used to have to declare CCTV on the annual registration, but they took that out when they changed it all around. In fact, I think they took it out in 2015, but certainly they took it out when the fee regulations came into place.
Sure.
But that made me do some searching, just Googling of ICO CCTV guidance. And I can't believe how out of date this stuff really is. You know, so there's a consultation paper draft revision to the CCTV code of practice. The code of practice published is 44 pages long, and it says it's out of date. GDPR is coming into effect, it's out of date. But it doesn't tell you how it's out of date, right? But then there's another code of practice which isn't as obvious on the ICO's website, which is the revised code of practice. Guess when it's dated?
Well, I know when it's dated because you sent me the email.
2014. Yeah. Right? So it's 2014, and it's not been adopted yet. And the law says, and that refers to the DPA 98 as well. So, you know, you're looking around. No wonder people get confused. You're looking around for the official guidance, and it's all, well, not all of it, but it's dramatically out of date. I think it's
absolutely. I mean,
I think it's terrible.
Yeah, it's a really complex area. I mean, again, to sort of touch on social housing again, because that's something that we obviously operate in heavily. But the absolute minefield of tenants putting up their own CCTV and what the responsibilities of the landlord are in relation to that. I'm sure if there are people from the sector on the floor, they'll understand the pain of that. But it's an incredibly complex area, and trying to get across to, you know, sort of the average person, the implications of it all and what they actually need to do if they want to set up essentially a camera which for which they would become a data controller. You know, how are you supposed to actually get that across?
Yeah, well, again, the guidance around this on the ICO's website is, I think, not particularly helpful for people who've got CCTV at home. But it does say that, which we know, if your CCTV captures images beyond your property boundary, then your the use of your system is subject to data protection laws. Well, what does that mean to you know, your average person?
No, it's a minefield. Mark, I know you've got your hand up. Do you want to dive in?
Yeah, I just want to hop in and say this is actually really good for us, because we've had such a case this week with a resident who, without landlord's consent, actually put a camera in a window in a top bedroom, which was actually looking out on a residential street on a cul-de-sac. So it actually wasn't even just a main road. And basically, I was approached for some guidance as to how they should approach the resident. Checked out, as you said, checked out the ICO's website and their suggestions as to how to approach it. And eventually, we just sort of like decided we would sit the resident down, explain to them that as a data controller, if anybody requested that information, they would be at liberty to disclose it. And once we actually explained the process of disclosing this information and making it available to them, they decided it would be too much of a pain in the bum, and they decided to take the camera down. So we didn't intentionally use scare tactics, but I think once you've actually had a chance to explain in layman's terms that as a data controller, you are liable to the same rules that everybody else does follow in terms of data protection, that kind of almost scares people off. And we're getting more and more of these now where people want to protect their own property. But I think what we did in the end was we gave them better guidance on where they should place their camera. And we sort of said to them, you know, if you do want to use a camera on your property, number one, you need landlord's consent. But number two, it's necessary to be mindful of where it's placed. You know, and they and then they said, oh, we'll get a Ring doorbell. And I was like, well, that's opens up a whole new can of worms, does a Ring doorbell, as we all know. But yeah, well, it's interesting that you mentioned in that, because we had a similar case just this week. So we kind of employed an inadvertent scare tactic, which made the actual resident think twice about using the camera in the position where it was left. So I think it's good to basically sit people down and explain to them in plain English what the implications are.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. It's difficult, isn't it? I'm dealing with a client at the minute who basically the neighbor to their property has put up all these CCTV cameras, which are very intrusive, and obviously they sort of want them to get rid of them. So we're sort of taking the approach of, I think, as you say, not necessarily scare tactics per se, but sort of explain, look, this is actually really quite an onerous thing to do compliantly, and if you don't start doing it compliantly because we think it's intrusive, we'll probably go and have a word with the ICO at some point. But it's a tricky line, because, you know, there are very good reasons a lot of the time, I assume, for installing the CCTV, but it's tricky to get right.
Yeah, I've just stuck a I remember 4 years ago, there was a Scottish court case. I mean, this was a bit, again, devil's in the detail here, but a Scottish couple were awarded compensation because their neighbour put CCTV, actually, and audio recording equipment, you know, on their property, including under their bedroom window, or pointing at their bedroom window. And that went on. So that's quite, again, an interesting case. But you can be using these kind of examples to highlight to your tenants, I guess, or, you know, these are the things you've got to contend with if you've got to put that up. But I don't think it's easy for people to, you know, look, you know, I don't think there's a culture in the UK of, you know, oh, I'm going to put a CCTV, I better check what regulations I've got to contend. It might be planning permission, but I don't think they're going to think, oh, I better check the ICO's website.
No, I doubt it. And I mean, sorry, yeah, I was just going to say, the problem is that obviously a lot of the time it's in the context of already quite hostile relations as well.
Yeah.
You don't just put a camera up for the sake of it. So you've got that on top. The client that I'm helping, sort of initially they said, as their sort of opening gambit to try and get the neighbour to get rid of the cameras, was, well, if you don't get rid of them, we're going to put in a SAR every day and you have to show us the footage every day.
Wow.
Which the neighbour batted back and said, well, no, I'm not doing that. So it's tricky. I mean, but...
And what do you think that would be? A manifestly unreasonable or excessive request?
Well, I think it would be, because fundamentally the purpose behind that, and I know that this is something we've talked about, is that in theory SARs have to be purpose blind, but in practice they're actually not a lot of the time. And if you were looking at manifestly unfounded, you probably would look at the purpose. And I think in this instance, because the purpose is fundamentally to try and get them to take the cameras down, you might have solid grounds to go back and say, well, actually, that's manifestly unfounded and potentially excessive. So I've advised them and said, look, mate, you can put in SARs, you still have the right to do that. But if you're going to do it, you need to be more proportionate about it. You can't just be saying, I want it every day, because then you essentially give the other party a chance to bat that back on the basis that it's manifestly unfounded.
I don't think it's manifest. Well, you're saying manifest. I was wondering if it would be manifestly excessive, you know, but I don't think it would be, I was going to say, because if you're wanting to see what personal data is being processed about you and is actually collected on a daily basis, it wouldn't seem excessive to ask for it on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of considerations here as well, because the people being monitored are vulnerable young people, so there's that to contend with. So, I mean, I think we've got, quote unquote, quite a strong case to get them to change the CCTV arrangements. But, you know, you have to go about these things carefully. You can't just go with the battering ram and claiming you want a SAR every day.
Yeah. Peter's mentioned, he says the SCC, I'm assuming it means the Security Camera Commissioner, because there is guidance. Again, Dilik often refers to that, but I don't particularly like that guidance because it's written for public authorities that are caught, you know, by the Security Surveillance Camera Commissioner. I think it's a bit excessive. I think it goes a bit too far. Certainly the DPIA asks a ton of questions. But I don't know if you agree with me, Peter, if you think I'm just being a bit negative about it. But I have to say I don't like that. I don't like the ICO's CCTV stuff. We took quite a lot of time developing our own CCTV assessment process for three housing associations. Actually asked us to kind of take the good and the good bits out of what was available and condense it into a process and a procedure. I don't know I think it's good, but then I'm biased, aren't I? But I don't know what anybody else thinks about the Security Camera Commissioner's work.
Yeah, it's interesting that Lars on the chat, and I don't know if you want to jump on, Lars, but makes an excellent point, which is that the Spanish regulator, the ADP, is it? AVD?
Yeah.
Have been very, very active on enforcing domestic CCTV. And I know that they've fined, I think, in two or three, potentially more instances recently, private individuals monitoring public spaces.
So I wonder why. I wonder what's driven that. Is it just a money-making scheme, or is there a genuinely...
I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? The one that I found really, really interesting, and I can't remember if this was a Spanish one, but it's certainly one of the European regulators. I think a couple of months ago, fined someone for putting in a fake camera. I think I raised this at the time, and I can't remember.
I saw that, yeah.
And they fined someone for putting in a fake camera because fundamentally they said that it was... it was like warping people's perception, and it was altering their behavior. It was putting them under a under the sort of I suppose the impression that they were being recorded, even though they weren't, and therefore they fine someone for that.
Yeah, but I wonder under what law though.
Well, exactly. That's what I thought. I thought, well, you're not actually processing any information there. So how on earth are you going to find them under data protection regulations?
How do people cope with, I'm interested to know, how people cope with the growing instances of tenants wanting to film repair people or customer service people? You know, so you go in and do a repair job and the tenant whips out their mobile phone and starts recording you doing it. Or, you know, you get somebody comes in to... reception in customer service or whatever and then, you know, starts to record what's going on. Again, I'm not sure whether people have found have that happen, but we had a spate of that happening, didn't we, Ollie?
We did. Well, I remember that we sort of addressed it, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we said that we essentially put together a policy for the organization saying that I think if you were the operative or the member of staff being filmed, you were at that point entitled to just stop the
repair or object
and just say, well, you know, if you're going to film me, I'm not going to come and fix your boiler or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And then putting out that it was company policy that tenants weren't allowed to do that or something. I can't quite remember how we did it.
That's it, but I'm not sure that was... Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I don't know if that's the best approach or anybody's got more recent, you know, approach which has worked particularly well in maybe not deterring it, but managing that kind of behaviour. But what we're finding is that people don't like it and they want to deter it.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because, well, it'd be caught by the household exemption, wouldn't it? So you wouldn't be able to... I don't know how you would enforce that, really.
It depends. Ultimately, you know, when you're recording it, you could say, well, it's for my own personal use, therefore it's household processing. But as soon as you want to do something with it, other than that, then you then become a data controller. That's what I love about this, the way that one minute you're not a data controller, next minute you are. One minute you're not a data processor, next minute you are. That's what I like about, one of the things I like about data protection. Laura, it's so, anyway.
No, it's interesting that Toby says that recording someone after they ask you to stop can count as harassment. I suppose it's a very good point, yeah.
But ultimately, you've got relationships with these people, and it's sometimes hard, isn't it? You know, sometimes you go in there to do a job and start filming in, you say, could you stop please, and they say no. Well, that's you know, it's quite a lot of pressure there to make a call as to whether you carry, shrug your shoulders and carry on, put a mask on, or I don't know what you're gonna do.
It puts you in a very difficult position, doesn't it? Lars highlighting that there's also a German case where a bicycle dash cam has been fined. Do you know what I saw? I think it was in Germany potentially, that I saw one where someone had been fined for, I think, taking pictures or filming people who were illegally parked and then reporting them to the local authority. And because his use of data was deemed to be unlawful, he was the one that was ultimately fined for doing it.
Sounds like Rains all over again, doesn't it?
Yeah, which I thought was very amusing.
Yeah, I saw an interesting, again, another article about changing topics. I'm quite happy to continue talking about CCTV, but handling data subject access requests and social media. Again, I think this is not something new, but again, this is Shoesmith's lawyers on Lexology writing about this and basically saying, you know, effectively the current guidance, which I think we know, is that if you allow or don't stop your employees using personal devices and social media platforms to communicate in performing their obligations and duties as an employee, then all those platforms and devices fall under the scope of a reasonable proportionate search. I was interested, what caught my eye on this article was the kind of, many employers will now be familiar with undertaking a reasonable proportional search. Well, I'm not sure people are, is what my first reaction, you know, because the ICO's guidance on one hand says even backup tapes might be in the scope and archives and things like that. And on the other hand, they're saying, you know, here, and the courts are saying a reasonable proportional search is all you need to do. But what they're saying in this article is that a reasonable and proportional search might include WhatsApp, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and people's personal devices. I mean, we know that anyway, don't we? But it was
Sorry, Phil.
No, dive in. I was going to dive in.
No, I was going to say, the line that really caught my eye, because I read through that the article you sent over, was they said at one point something to the effect of that, you know, those social media accounts or the personal device might be in scope of a DSAR if the employer has reasonable grounds to believe that there's relevant information contained in there, or something to that effect.
Yeah, it does.
And again, that's a real uncertainty, isn't it? So at what point are you deemed to have a good enough suspicion that there is information there that you need to be looking for?
Yeah, but I mean, even if you determine there isn't likely to be anything in there, and you document that fact, you know, because we don't recommend them to use it for whatever purpose. Or we do allow it, but you know, we've taught. I mean, the way I've got around it, the way I've addressed it in the past in subject access requests is to remember one came up in the summer. And the client was saying, well, it's impossible to collect all these devices together because of COVID restrictions and that kind of stuff. And I said, well, just write to them, email them all. I said, do you like to have any personal data relating to this data subject on any of your devices or platforms? Of course, everyone came back, no. Right, well, we've done a reasonable proportion. We've got no reason to believe there's anything on there. So how's the ICO going to challenge that? If you've got, you know, a good, and I've always said this, haven't I, for ages, if you've got a good process or a process that looks good, the ICO is on, it's hard for the ICO to challenge it. Oh, he's good. Ollie's just put in the chat, sorry, I've got to dive off for his living. Anyway, it is hard for the ICO to challenge it. And we found that in the past. I don't know if anybody's got any experience of this, but you know, performing a reasonable portion of search is not something the ICO suggests, but something that the courts do suggest. I won't wait for Ollie to come back. I'll just plow on.
But sorry, I'm here.
Oh, you're on, right? Okay, I was talking to the ether, and then I looked down and I saw, got to dive off for a sec. All right, okay.
Yeah, apologies. I've just had to bolt up and down.
Yeah,
both flights of stairs.
It's because you've been on the 13th floor, isn't it?
Yeah, well, being on the third is bad enough.
Yeah. So I was just saying, Oliver, in my experience, if you can put a good case together, the ICO struggles to challenge it. And what we found, in they'll come back and say, have a look at this again. Well, that's what their normal approach is, isn't it? And you say, well, we looked at it again and we've come to the same conclusion.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, that was again something that caught my eye this week. I did see that the European Data Protection Board has issued some guidance on the lead supervisory authorities and reasoned objections to decisions that they make. But of course, now we're out of the European Union, that doesn't affect us, does it? But that, I'm going to have a read of that as well, because I think that might be quite interesting to read through.
Yeah, no, certainly. I did have a look through one of the pieces you sent over, which was in relation to Vodafone being fined by the Spanish regulator. And the breakdown of that fine, did you dive into that much?
I didn't. To be honest, Ollie, that has been open on my desktop for about 2 weeks. You know what I'm like, I've got my tabs lined up in browser. That one's been there. It's nearly at the far left-hand side. It's fifth in. So it's been there for some time. I do want to read it, because what they've done is they've levied four fines for different violations.
Yes.
So I want to try and read through it and get to the bottom of, you know, how they've arrived at what's been violated and why they've determined a particular level of fee. Did you have a chance to look at it or not?
Yes, I did. I did have a glance through it, but you'll have to forgive me if it's a bit high level. I certainly suggest you go and dig into it, because it is very interesting. I mean, broadly speaking, the fines have come because Vodafone, it's all around their marketing, broadly speaking. Unsurprisingly, contacting people with unsolicited direct marketing.
Oh, they're terrible for that. They are terrible for that.
They are terrible. And then sort of failing to properly action objection requests, sorry. So basically, the breakdown of the fines covers all of this. But one which I found very interesting, and one of the fines in particular that, you know, this relates to, is that Vodafone seemed to, as part of this, I've tried to palm off some of the blame for the objection request not being appropriately actioned onto one of their processors, because they said that we employed this system from a supplier which should have registered the objections properly, and, you know, those people wouldn't have been contacted. And the APD have come right back and said, well, if they're a processor, it was your responsibility to risk assess them properly. You failed Article 28, so you're getting fined for that.
Right.
Which I thought was Yeah, quite amusing.
Yeah. Now, they're terrible, Vodafone. I get, I mean, I'm a Vodafone customer. I've never consented to receive marketing information from them, as far as I'm aware. It's probably a small print, but I get text all the time from them. I tell you what was odd, right? I had reason to go to the hospital on Wednesday evening, and I got there and I registered with the reception in the department I was going to, and they asked me for my phone number, and I literally went and sat down on a seat, and I got a text from them saying, regarding your recent visit to South Tees Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust OPD, we would value your feedback, and a link to a thing which I haven't done. I'm not even had my appointment yet. But I wasn't asked whether they wanted to send me a survey. Do they need to ask me? Not Darren Martin, is it? But I mean, surely it's legitimate interest, presumably. But it was just a surprise to me, to be honest.
Well, that's probably then a failing on transparency and fairness. Then you've not expected your data to be used in that way. They've not gone to sufficient lengths to tell you that they'll do that. I mean, how big of an issue it is, I suppose, is, you know,
it's not a big issue
scale, but that's where it would lie.
It's not a big issue, but it was a surprise. Rob's saying that Vodafone is the only network provider that rereads the number as part of a personalised voicemail. I don't know what he means about that. I don't listen to my voicemails anyway, Rob, as you well know. What do you mean, Rob? Now, so Pete's also asked if there's any news on when the standard contractual clause is going to be adopted. I don't think there is yet. I think it's still sat out there, isn't it, waiting to get debated and approved.
Just on that, Phil. So, for example, if you're phoning through a switchboard and you speak to someone and they transfer you through to someone's work mobile or personal mobile, whatever that may be, then if you get an immediate voicemail, then you have obviously access to that number because it rereads it, although that person may not have consented to obviously give you their personal or work mobile at that front. And I guess that comes down to the organisation, I guess, as well, doesn't it? And if, you know, they probably shouldn't be putting you through without the consent in advance, but it's just an interesting one I thought I'd mention.
Yeah, no, good one. Good one. Now, I'm talking next week, Ollie, at a couple of events on the Age Appropriate Design Code of Conduct. So I've been rereading that, which is, again, that's been interesting. I was speaking this week at a couple of events on getting the most out of your data. Again, I hope the people have got a view on this as well. And my premise was, I think that the current law has got enough in the privacy practitioner's toolkit to allow the maximization of data. You know, we've got data protection by design, we've got data protection impact assessments, we've got accountability framework, we've got legitimate interest assessments. And I'm not sure. I mean, so I was trying to dispel this fear of this culture of fear notion. And I was also talking about the UK National Data Strategy and the some of the angles that the government are pushing, you know, data seen as opportunities to be embraced rather than threats to be guarded against. And then the announcement about the new ICO's role is going to be kind of shifted from not only enforcement and education, but also trying to create a culture in the UK where, you know, data can be reused and reused, and it's a much more open culture. So I was kind of talking about that, but I don't know whether you feel that we've got enough tools or whether they're not fit for purpose. But I think, you know, I think the problem is, which we say all the time when we talk about DPIAs, tools are there, but they're not often used properly. You know, people are doing data protection impact assessments, but they're not doing them well. They're not considering all of the factors, and they're arriving, in some cases, at the wrong conclusions. Again, I don't know.
Yeah, I completely 100% agree with you. And actually, it ties into what Steph has just put in the chat, which is a really interesting aspect to all this at the minute. So saying that, interesting question regarding SARs on personal devices, but given working from home, is not a bigger challenge the use of business chat software, etc., Slack. Because I've been through this with a number of clients where they are looking to use maybe WhatsApp as part of, you know, internal comms, or they're using the two Facebook products, Workplace and Work Chat. And that's a real, real difficult thing to get right. So I'm doing DPIAs into them, and I have to say, a lot of time my conclusion is, don't use WhatsApp internally, especially if you're, because I've seen this in the housing sector where they want to use it to communicate with tenants. I can't see, or at least I struggle to see, a way in which that can be properly managed and regulated. And you talk about SARs, you know, if you've got tenant information in sort of accounts, WhatsApp accounts on staff phones that are maybe personal phones. I mean, how are you going to retrieve that?
How are you going to search for it? I was going to ask you the question. How are you going to search for it? So the nature of WhatsApp, as everyone knows probably more than me being a Luddite, is, you know, you get photos, you get screenshots, you get videos, you get text, you get a whole host of stuff, don't you? But I don't know whether there's any way to do a global search, which I can't imagine there is, you know, to find information about what you're looking for.
No, there isn't. And I mean, those sorts of things, I would often argue, are absolutely 100% open to function creep in the worst possible way. I remember hearing a story, and I can't remember where this was from, but from a housing provider I was working with some time ago, where they were saying that a member of staff had been communicating with a tenant over WhatsApp, and the tenant was saying that they were having issues paying their bill because, you know, they were having financial difficulties that month, but that they'd updated their profile picture and status on WhatsApp to show that they've been on holiday somewhere very recently. And the member of staff is saying, well, hang on a second. If you're so skinned, why are you on holiday currently? Oof. And you sort of go, oh, I'm not really sure you should be nosing around like that. Yeah. Because, But yeah, no, it's extremely difficult. These platforms, but as you say, you know, if you do your DPIAs properly, then there is scope to use that sort of platform, but you have to do them well. You have to do them thoroughly.
Keep them under review and recognize the weaknesses as well. I tell you, I was astounded the first time I found that WhatsApp, you know, when I started using it a couple of years ago, that I found all these pictures in my gallery. I thought, I don't remember taking that. How the hell did I get in my gallery? And they're obviously put in there by WhatsApp. Other people's pictures.
It's quite alarming,
isn't it, the first time you find it?
It automatically saves the pictures you get sent to your gallery. Which, obviously, that, you know, how big of a deal is that, you might say. But then, if it's doing that, there's sort of the voice in the back of your head that says, well, what else is it doing automatically? Without you knowing. And I know there's a lot of anxiety around their updated terms and conditions, and obviously there's a lot of anxiety around Facebook's misuse of data and everything that's come out in the wake of Schrems too, because I'm hearing a lot of this from clients saying, oh, we've got to risk assess this. But I often sort of retort that your biggest risk isn't in data going to America. Your biggest risk is that currently you're using platforms that you have absolutely no control over. Mm-hmm. You can't enforce subject rights procedures properly. You can't enforce retention properly. You've got no idea what's going in and out. That's where your risk is. Not that it might get shipped over to America and intercepted by the CIA.
It's a good point. I don't know if Matthew. I think Matthew's on. I don't know if he's got anything he wants to say. But what I was saying, if you do, Matthew, just butt in. But on the age appropriate design stuff, Ollie, I was doing some sort of prep for that, and with that made me look at a couple of websites like Unifrog and a website called The Power of 10 that athletes use to record all their performances on. And in fact, Peppa Pig Maths, and I've been having fun looking at all sorts of stuff. But Unifrog is funded by advertising, which I didn't know. So when, you know, people are looking for what university to go for, the school says set up an account on Unifrog, and it's a process for looking at universities and kind of helping pull applications together. And the power of 10, you know, if you compete in an athletic competition somewhere, 1500 meters or whatever, then all, and it's a competition organized by a sports club registered with the English Athletics, then those results go on the power of 10 thing. And that's how the UK rankings are organized in all the age categories. And all that, again, funded by advertising and by partner revenues. Well, I was quite surprised about that. And why I'm mentioning it is because the Age Appropriate Design Code of Conduct says if anything's funded in that kind of way, you know, it's a digital service, it might be like used by children, it's all caught by the code of practice. But it just wasn't obvious to me that Unifrog, I was looking in the privacy policies where I found it, you know, we might disclose your information to our partners and sponsors and advertisers, but it's not clear at all.
So, yeah, because you've been working on this quite heavily, but my understanding of that aspect of applicability of the code was slightly different. I was under the impression that it sort of applied to the websites and providers that it applies to, regardless of remuneration. as opposed to remuneration being a factor in whether
it applies? Remuneration is a factor. So the conditions are public authority. Again, I'm assuming it's taken its definition. This is interesting, right? Because we're going to the education technology show next week. Public authority defined in the DPA as anybody in, is it Schedule 1 of the Freedom of Information Act? Schedule 1.
Yes,
yeah. So we know that state schools are caught by the FOIA, but independent schools aren't. So does that mean that an independent school is not a public authority, but state school is for the purposes of the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice? Not sure. Again, I've asked the ICO these direct questions and I've not got any response yet. So public authority, remuneration is one of them. So it actually says, you know, if it's funded by some sort of commercial model, whether that's through advertising revenues or whatever, then it, again, it's going to be caught by the regulations. And there's a couple of others that I can't remember off the top of my head what they are. But you know, ultimately used likely to be used by under 18s. So it's in there as one of the factors to consider. You know, but the exemptions again are incredibly woolly worded. Woolly, if that's such a word exists. Because one of them refers to two examples that the guidance gives are a police force, you know, is using, you know, a digital service. Da, da, da. Well, of course, they're exempt according to the guidance because they don't have to comply with the GDPR. They have to comply with the Law Enforcement Directive, don't they? The Data Protection Act.
Right,
so that's one example to give. And the second example to give is a public authority. And it says if the service they provide is normally or so usually commercially available, then they might be caught by it. But it doesn't say by whom. You know, so if I'm a public authority, I've decided to fund it from in a different way, you know, directly from our own reserves, whatever. Just because everybody else does it a commercial way, does that mean that I'm caught by the code? It's not really clear at all. But when I'm doing this talk next week with this guy who's gonna say that he thinks it's an ICO vanity project and everyone's gonna ignore it as soon as Elizabeth Denham is left and it's gonna die a death. But I'm not so sure.
No, I'm not so sure. I mean, it's an interesting one, and I've mentioned a couple of times in previous weeks that I think it directly applies to a number of my clients. But I remember reading it at the time when it first came out and really struggling, and I still really struggle with the applicability of it. Who's actually accountable? Who's responsible for all of this? Because it's not exactly the easiest code to comply with. I mean, it's not the hardest either, but there are some things in there which I think are quite a high standard, really.
Yeah, they are. And what basically ultimately we're saying to people is, you know, you need to find out if the services you provide are caught by this. And if you're providing those services, you know, you have built this web platform and you're providing it, then you're responsible for complying with the code. But if you haven't, so a school that's recommending you to use Unifrog, they don't have to comply with the code because it's Unifrog's responsibility to comply with the code. But to what extent, you know, is a school having to do due diligence on these web digital services they're recommending people are using? I would have thought that they are responsible for taking some form of due diligence, you know, and checking out the providers that they're recommending use. But again, that's not really clear from the code.
No, it's difficult. I mean, I've had a lot of interactions with some of our education sector clients where, because obviously a big thing in schools is online learning resources, and you get the teachers recommending all sorts. So sometimes it's, you know, actually part of lessons, but sometimes it's just an extra, oh, if you're interested, you can go and check out, you know, BBC Bite Size or whatever it is in your own time.
You see, Bite Size. Go on, carry on. Sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say, actually sort of keeping a handle on all of that and trying to, you know, actually keep a register, understanding what it is that's being recommended to the kids, what's being used, etc. And then potentially having to risk assess some of it, depending on, you know, where your liabilities might stand, which I think is what you're getting at. It's an absolute nightmare. I mean, I've worked with the schools on it, and we've gotten to a pretty good place with it, but it's really quite difficult, real battle to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be telling people, you know, what you've got to do, I think, is certainly raise communications internally about the code of practice. And then I think it's very similar to processors, you know, assess what services you offer and create a register, same as you would do for processors. Then assess which of those services are caught by the code of practice and which aren't, because not all of them probably are. And then, you know, implement a policy controlling the use or recommendation of these services, as you would do with a processor. And then a procedure for vetting services if teachers want to use them or anyone wants to use them, and adding them onto the register, exactly as you would do with a processor. Then, you know, in this case, completing an assessment of each service, which has got to comply with all 15 principles. If it was a processor, you'd be checking out the contract, wouldn't you? Article 28 provisions. And then where you're finding non-compliances, you know, draft a action plan or corrective action per service you recommend, and then some kind of ongoing compliance. So it isn't rocket science, but getting under the skin of it is quite hard. And because it's an extension of the Data Protection Act, you know, the ICO says, you know, they can fine people 4% of turnover or £17.5 million for non-compliance. Bite size is interesting. I'm going to raise this next week. I'm just raising it to try and prompt people's thoughts, but that's funded effectively through the license fee model, isn't it? So where do you draw the line when you're saying, you know, the ICO refers to, you know, if something is part of economic activity, then it's more likely to be caught by the code of practice. Well, what about the license fee? Is it so far removed that it's exempted or not? I don't know.
That is very difficult. In the end, what we did, just to sort of provide a bit of closure, I suppose, on that, is that I worked with the governance team at one of the schools in developing essentially a checklist for the staff and the teachers to work through when they want to use a new resource, which outputs a particular risk score and then tells them what they need to do next, whether it needs to go through the governance team, whether it needs to be approved by the DPO or the data protection lead or whoever it might be, or whether on the face of it they're, you know, okay to just proceed with it. That's the approach we took, as you say, almost like essentially doing due diligence on a processor, going through that really tightly controlled process.
I don't know if you've got anything else to raise. I saw quite an interesting read as well, which I'm gonna put it. It's only interesting if you like reading this kind of nonsense. But this is about joint controllers. So the thing that stands out is you don't need to access personal data to be a joint controller of it. You don't need to be involved in the deciding, and you don't need to be involved in deciding the means of the processing. So this is again, it's an interesting discussion paper or blog from Osborne Clark and another good law firm from Lexology, the newsletter. Again, it's quite interesting to have a quick scan through that, and you know, we like doing this, don't we, because it's challenging your understanding of the way the law's working in practice.
Well, did I put the query to you that I had last week or the week before last on joint controllers? It was extremely complicated.
I don't remember that. It must have been on holiday.
I think it might have been when you were off. The essence of it. Unavailable. The essence of it, without wanting to go into too much detail, spending too much time on it, is that my clients basically have almost sort of like an applicant tracking system for school leavers. It was a similar vein to a degree to what UCAS do, I suppose. And their system had been purchased by a local council and offered up to all the schools in that area. And the schools would use it whenever one of the kids wanted to apply for whatever apprenticeship they might be doing. And they came to us and said, well, are we now joint controllers, the schools and the local authority? Because the local authority have procured the product, but the schools are making decisions about how it's being used. And it's all going down this real rabbit hole of, you know, where liabilities might be, who's actually responsible, is it joint controllership? If it's joint controllership, do we almost have sort of a hierarchy between them, a lead controller and possibly one that's sort of, you know, got a lesser responsibility in it all? It can be really, really complicated.
See, I've not heard the phrase lead controller. I don't think I've heard the phrase lead controller used. But
no, that's probably because Dave and I made it up.
Interesting notion to try and confuse people even more, maybe.
Yeah, well, that's our aim at the end of the day. No, but I mean, because I've seen it a number of times where you've essentially got, because another one of my clients have a similar scenario, whereby you technically have joint controllers, but there's one who basically has just commissioned the processing and doesn't really have anything else to do with it. Mm. So they're still in a position of joint controllership, but They're a dataless controller, which is one of the things that this gets at. You don't have to have access to data to be a joint controller. And they basically don't do anything. So you've almost got, yeah, this made up notion that we've come up with, but of a sort of lead controller, almost in a joint control scenario.
Yeah, it's just remind us about Fashion ID. Fashion ID was in a good case. I haven't really got time to dwell on that now, but that good point is that's interesting. But all those judgments that have been published in the last 12 months or so about, you know, people saying, oh, I'm not a controller, it's Facebook that's a controller, and you know, oh, I'm a processor. They're all quite interesting to read why those decisions have been made. Again, I love reading this type of stuff because it starts to redraw the lines, really, of potentially, you know, where you understand those lines are, or certainly what I think, rather than lines, you end up with bands of grey, don't you? Where that falls in this band of grey, yeah. And that one likes to fall in that band of grey. It's much more of a continuum, isn't it?
No, definitely.
Listen, you've done it again, Ollie. We're only meant to be doing this for half an hour. We've been nearly an hour on it. You just rabbit on far too much.
I was about to draw things to a close. I was about to say,
pulling your leg.
Unless anyone has got anything else to raise at this point, and if there's any more questions or anything else, you can obviously fire them in and we can get back to you over email or save them for next week and we can have a chat. You know, these sessions are recurring, so we're not going anywhere. But that's probably going to be it.
What are you doing next week? What have you got on next week?
What have I got on next week? I'm doing just a whole bunch of DPIAs at the minute.
Oh, are you?
On various different projects and systems and products and all sorts. So that's me.
I've got to do a mental change of gear, which you know I struggle with. So I'm doing 3 days a week for 3 weeks of PCI DSS assessments one of the UK's biggest retailers, which is interesting. So next week I'm doing 3 days of store visits in the West Midlands. Again, I'm going to be looking at what the procedures are for swapping out point of interaction devices, the procedures for changing staff, for training staff, the incident management procedures. So I'm doing it with a colleague, Jamie. He's looking at 12 stores. I'm looking at 8 stores, and he's also looking at the contact center and Fujitsu, who's their supplier that swaps out the point of interaction devices, and looking at their e-commerce site. But that's going to be busy, so I've got to try and get my head around PCI, which I've not done any PCI work for, I think, since October. So I'm going to be on the back foot, possibly on that maybe. And then what will happen is I'm coming back in to do this EduTech thing on Wednesday afternoon. I'll have forgotten about the age appropriate design code of conduct. Yeah, you know how my brain is small.
Yeah, well. Good. I can only wish you the best of luck with all that. Right, well, thanks everyone for joining. We'll hope to see you again next week. We'll be putting out this session as a recording on the podcast feeds, as we always do. But in the meantime, any questions, just fire in, and hopefully we'll see you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thanks all.
Yeah, thanks everyone for attending. Have a good weekend.
Yes, thank you, Rob. We're doing Pekka next week. I completely forgot.